History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And what we hope to demonstrate is that they don't have to go untold, as long as somebody's willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then be patient enough to listen as memories that may not have seen the light of day for decades emerge from the shadows again. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often, don't we? We end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We all know this is Father's Day weekend, a special time for all of you who still have your father here on earth to celebrate, but also a reminder for those of us whose fathers have passed. For some of you, this will be your first Father's Day since your dad passed away, and that applies in the case of so many amazing World War II veterans you've gotten to meet here on the radio who have finished their journey on Earth since last Father's Day. While we've met some amazing female veterans on Hometown Heroes over the years, the overwhelming majority of vets we get to talk to are men, and the vast majority of those men are fathers themselves. So many have shared powerful memories relating to their own fathers. We couldn't possibly have time to explore all those moments today, but we are going to try to attach a Father's Day theme this weekend as we look through the eyes of our veterans at that special relationship between father and child. We've heard many a veteran tell that story of not being able to be present for a child's birth because he was fighting overseas and didn't meet his son or daughter till he got home, sometimes years later. We've heard from veterans who became Gold Star fathers when their sons were killed in Vietnam. We've heard some of the tender moments from farewells and reunions. And one story that sticks out for me comes from Navy veteran Grant Erickson, the 10th of 11 children in his family and one of five brothers serving in World War II. He received frequent letters from his mother during his time on the battleship USS New Mexico, surviving multiple kamikaze attacks, including one that killed his captain 6 feet away. But only one letter ever came from Grant's father, and boy, did it mean a lot.
Well, it really did, because I think being the 10th born in a family of 11, we were never that close.
Sure.
I always kind of had the feeling that I could never quite satisfy my dad, you know, although he was always there when he needed to be there, you know. Mm-hmm. And I knew that he loved me, but that was quite a letter.
I don't know if this is asking my much too much, but you think you could try to read it for us?
Oh, I probably could. Would you like me to read? Okay. I wish I had the power to write the thoughts wedged in my heart tonight. As I sit watching that small star and wondering how and where you are. You know, son, it's a funny thing how close a war can always bring a family who for years with pride have kept emotion deep inside. I'm sorry that when you were small, I let reserve build up that wall. I told you real men never cried. And it was moms who always dried your tears and smoothed the hurt away so you couldn't go back to play. But son, deep down within my heart, I long to have some little part in drying that small tear-stained face. But we were men. Men don't embrace. Now suddenly I find my son a full-grown man with childhood done. Tonight you're far across the sea and waging war for men like me. Well, somehow pride and what is right just do not seem to go tonight. I find my eyes won't stay quite dry. I find that sometimes men do cry. And if we stood here face to face, I fear we'd find men do embrace. Son, dads are quite a funny lot. And if I've failed you in some spot, it's not because I love you less. It's just that thing called manliness. But if I had the power to write the thoughts wedged in my heart tonight, the words would ring out loud and true. I'm proud, my boy, so proud of you. I got through it.
You did. Where were you when you got that letter?
That was after our ship was hit, actually, in January. Sometime between that time and the time we were in Okinawa, they hit the second time.
And your father is expressing things there that he had never expressed before. And he's sharing with you that his eyes aren't dry. I bet yours weren't either when you read it.
They weren't, really. Yeah, I'm not the crying type, but yeah, the tears came, yeah.
Especially on that last line, I bet.
Yeah.
I'm proud, my boy, so proud of you.
Surely many other sons received similar sentiments during World War II, memories that would guide them as fathers later on. And if you were to listen to Grant Erickson's complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com, you would hear several mentions of the USS Indianapolis, a cruiser that operated in close proximity to the battleship New Mexico. By now, most of us are familiar with the Indianapolis and its tragic fate. There are books, there are movies, but in 2022, very few survivors. As of today, there are only two men still with us who survived the sinking of the Indianapolis in July 1945, shortly after the ship had delivered components of the atomic bomb to Tinian. One of those two survivors, Harold Bray, just celebrated his 95th birthday this week in California's East Bay. Now he'll get to have a happy Father's Day as well. Harold's father had served in the British Army in World War I, and Harold convinced him to sign for him to enlist in the Navy. The teenager went straight from boot camp to the cruiser Indianapolis, but in the early morning hours of July 30th, 1945, he was not sleeping in his normal bunk on the third deck down.
Well, it was called hot bunk, you know, when you got out, another guy got in.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 1,100 or 1,200 guys on that boat. It was a little overkill because, well, during the war, you just were there to replace somebody that got hit or something.
Typically, you would sleep below deck, but because it was so hot, they told you you can sleep topside?
Yeah, that's where I slept on number two turret. I took a sleeping bag and a pillow, and I put it on top of the turret. And I remember it right, I took my shoes off and my clothes on, and when about midnight, a little after midnight, we got hit. And when the torpedoes hit right on the opposite side of the ship of me, and it rolled me off of that, I was like a 10-foot drop,
mm-hmm.
And I seen my shoes go over the side, and I was dressed with dungarees on, and I was sleeping on the open like that, and I got down on the quarter deck, and it was just amazing. It seemed like we carried like 87 Marines. It seemed like they were all right there on the quarter deck when I got down there, and they start to bail off. We were still on her way. I never got in the water till she was on her side. I was forward of the quarter deck. I got down on the quarter deck, and guys were going nuts or running all over the place. Some guys were hit. Some guys were bleeding. Some guys. I stopped at the quarter deck just to get my bearings, and my shop was at the Fantail. I was a ship fitter. So I made my way back to. I went through the hangar deck, and I grabbed some kind of tools, and I headed back to the Fantail. On the way back, I grabbed a life jacket. The guy was throwing them out of a pocket, and I got back to the Fantail, and there were three guys laying up against the bulkhead. One guy was bleeding pretty bad, and I gave him my life jacket. I helped him up to the lifeline. I made sure that he jumped off right forward of the propellers. We got him over the side. We were on the Fantail, so she was laying on her side in the water. I went back and got another one. And all that time, she was keeling over. And by the time I got back to the Fantail, she was on her side. And instead of floating off, I climbed over the rail and ran down the side of the ship to the quarter deck instead of floating off the Fantail. I was going to stay dry as long as I could. When I went over the rail, I had to run forward to get away from the shafts. Screws were still turning. So I ran to the quarter deck, and that's where most of the guys were piling off there. They're all gathered there, but she was going down fast. And so I got in the water. And when I hit the water, somebody hit me and drove me down. I opened my eyes up in the water, and I could see the guys, the lights. And, of course, stupid me opened my eyes in the salt water. That was not the thing to do. But I hit the surface, and when I come to the surface, I looked back, and she was up on her bow. She was halfway sunk already, mm-hmm. And the guys were still coming off. And I swam away from her. I was kind of pulled, and I swam away from her and got on a raft. One guy was on, we had a raft. So we picked up, I think we picked up 80 guys that night. And then, of course, we had a crash net, and we tied it to the raft. And so the guys would hang on to something. And, of course, as the days go on, the guys got sick or died from wounds they had. And I came through it pretty good. I got my whole side was burned on my left side. But other than that, it was okay. But the guys were hurt pretty bad.
A couple of things I want to ask you about there. One, do I understand correctly that that was the very first night you were sleeping topside?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, my deck was three decks down next to sick bay. My bunk was here. There was a stack of three bunks, and I was on the top bunk. The sick bay was right there. So.
And isn't that about where the torpedo hit?
Yeah, it did. Yeah, it hit right, blew sick bay out of there.
If this were the night before,
yeah,
when you were sleeping down there, or if you hadn't decided to go topside that night, you wouldn't have made it out of there.
No, I don't know why. Well, because it's so hot.
Yeah.
And decided to sleep up on top of a steel deck rather than in my bunk. That was kind of stupid, but it saved my life. If I was in my bunk area, I would have been killed right there. I would never made it out.
And another thing I read about your experience, I think it might have been in Sarah Vladek and Lynn Vincent's book when they talk about your story, that before you abandoned ship, that I think it was Frenchie said to you, the ship's going down, and you couldn't believe it.
Yeah, Frenchie told me, you better get going, Bray. She's going down. I said, where is it going to go? Where is it going to go?
You had never considered that possibility.
Yeah.
That this beautiful ship could sink.
And at that point, we didn't know how bad she was hit, but she had taken two torpedoes, midship, one forward, and one midship. But she was still upright. But then the water came and started listing right away. When I went in the water, she was on her side. Of course, when I hit the water, somebody drove me down about 30, 40 feet. It seemed like I was never going to get back up there.
Well, and when you did, I think you found it wasn't all just water, right? There's a lot of oil in the water.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was about like 4 inches. Well, I had oil in my eyes, my ears, everything. It was a ruptured oil tank or something when we got hit.
I'm just trying to imagine what goes through the mind of an 18-year-old who is woken up by a torpedo hitting his ship, who falls to the next deck, whose shoes go overboard, who then he's going overboard, and now you're in the water in the dark, not knowing what's going on. What in the world were you thinking?
I don't know. I thought the Navy did that to everybody.
You and hundreds of other sailors aboard the Indianapolis are watching that ship go down, and you're in the water. Looking back now, you know what you went through over the 4 or 5 days that followed. But at that point, as you grab onto this raft and other guys are coming alongside, did you guys think you were going to be rescued? Was there any talk of what's going to happen next?
No, we didn't. Of course, we're by ourselves, no escort. We wondered about that, but they said, well, your ship was so fast it didn't need an escort. We were the fastest ship in the fleet at the time. But that was kind of ridiculous even. Most every ship had a destroyer with them, and we were by ourselves. And that was a big mistake, hindsight, you know.
And I'm guessing that you all would assume the ship was able to send out an SOS, a distress call.
Well, it would have, but CIC was hit, and it was just shut everything down. We didn't even get an abandoned ship.
But you guys in the water don't know that.
No.
So the reality is you've sunk, and no one in the Navy knows about it.
No, we're by ourselves.
And this would be just the first night, really just the morning, till the sun came up. Did that feel like it was days or weeks or years? I mean, what did that feel like as a teenager going through that?
I don't know. I thought Navy did that to everybody.
Breaking you in.
Yeah. I don't know what my thoughts were. I know it was kind of I don't remember even getting scared when we got hit. It seemed like I knew what to do, but nobody ever told me what to do.
And you're injured. You're burned?
Yeah. My whole left side was, my clothes were gone. I didn't blister much. My arm was blistered, my left, it was all on my left side, but that salt water didn't do it any good.
So how much pain were you in?
but it burns, you know, until it scabbed over, and it was a couple of days. The salt water was no fun to be in with open sores.
Well, especially when there are sharks in the vicinity, too.
Yeah.
And I just want everybody to understand the situation. So you're burned. You're covered in oil. You have no food, no water?
No, no. Well, the oil kind of protected you from the sun. Because we were oiled from head to toe, in eyes and mouth, tongue. Still taste it to this day.
Oof.
It was, you didn't have enough sense to close your mouth when you hit the water. I drank about a half a quart of oil, I think. But then you start throwing up, and after that's over, you're okay. But being just out of boot camp, you know, didn't expect anything like that.
And you mentioned, you know, more time that goes by, more guys latch on to this raft with the net attached,
right, yeah,
floating there. Did you guys talk to each other much?
Well, I don't remember what we talked about, but you didn't know anybody. I went on board with 10 other guys, and they weren't in that group I was in. We got split up in the water, three groups, and we were the biggest group, I guess. I don't know how many guys, we ended up with 80 guys in our, but when we got picked up, there was 18 of us 5 days later.
Well, and the tragic reality of the Indianapolis is that even though 900 of the almost 1,200 survived the sinking, by the time you're picked up almost 5 days later, there's only 316 of you still alive.
Yeah.
So we know that over those days, there are a lot of things that were happening to claim these lives. What was your first awareness that sharks were in the area?
Well, the guys were getting hit. The guys that were bleeding, sharks were taking them first. But you weren't exempted. On the outer edge of this group, I think we counted up the first morning, we were 80 of us. And then with this group, we had a crash net, you know what a floater net is?
Yeah.
We had one of those and a raft. We tied it together. They had something to hang on to because even with a Pecos life jacket, it was only good for so many hours, you know.
I think it was like 3 days, right? 72 hours or something?
Something like that.
Yeah.
And you had to have somebody or something to hang on to because we were in the water for over 100 hours. So I don't know what kept me alive, but I came through it pretty good shot, except for the burns. That was okay. There were flash burns, weren't deep burns.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of guys are a lot worse than me.
So you're 18 years old, you're burned, you're covered in oil, no food, no water, and now you're seeing other guys eaten by sharks right in front of your eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And the sharks had to come close to you, too.
Oh, so I got hit a couple of times. One got bumped in the rib cage. I thought he had me that time. But the face is so pointed. He just bumped me to see if I was still alive or something. And swam off. But that was the closest it came. That was pretty, pretty scary. Because guys were getting hit all the time. If you're any kind of wound and you're bleeding, you're just shark bait as well. When they picked us up, I was sleeping and hanging on to whatever it was. I was tired. I was in the water 4 days already.
And you hadn't had anything to eat or drink?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing.
How much weight did you lose?
35 pounds or less.
In 5 days?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you must not have had much strength left when they're trying to pick you up.
No, I couldn't even lift my arms out of the water. They were there for a long time.
Can you describe for us what that feels like with everything that you'd been through when you finally are put on that LCVP going back to the Bassett and you know for the first time you're actually going to live? What did that feel like?
Probably I was happy. It was just a miracle that anybody even found us.
USS Indianapolis survivor Harold Bray, who celebrated his 95th birthday this week and now has Father's Day to enjoy as well. It's time for our first break, but when this special Father's Day weekend edition of Hometown Heroes continues, a story that is more than just hard to believe, it almost seems impossible. So often I hear from listeners who say their dad never talked about what he did in World War II, so listening to other veterans' memories helped them imagine what it must have been like for dad. But what if you randomly met someone who served with your late father and could fill in some of those blanks? Stay tuned. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special Father's Day weekend edition of the program. So many of you often tell me that you wish you would have heard more of your father's military memories before he passed, and that listening to veterans share their stories on Hometown Heroes helps you imagine what it must have been like for your dad. It's often possible to find out quite a bit even after a veteran is gone. You can request files from the National Archives. There are substantial research resources on the internet. And it's also possible for a chance encounter to open whole new avenues of discovery. That's what we learned from Vietnam veteran Les Beck, whose World War II prisoner of war father had been gone for 20 years when a magic moment like that occurred for him. Les himself is a Purple Heart recipient.
I was wounded on 31 January 1968 during the Tet Offensive.
How did that happen?
The Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese troops were trying to overrun our base camp near Long Binh, and I responded with a team out to gate number 6 and lay down suppressive fire to stop their assault and got wounded and evacuated as a result.
And as a result of that and your service, you received treatment at the VA Medical Center, and that's the place where this connection was made. But to understand the connection, we need to understand your background. And if your father were alive, I would have loved to sit down with him for a while because he had quite a story. He was so eager to get involved in World War II that he went north of the border to Canada?
That's correct. In 1941, he went to Canada and volunteered to serve over in Europe and originally joined the Polish Air Force and flew a few missions with them, but found it so difficult to communicate with them that he transferred to the RAF, which was his second stint. And then from there, when the Americans got involved, he joined the United States Army Air Corps in England.
And how much did you ever know about what he did in World War II? Did he tell you much about it?
No, I remember him showing me all the scars he had, but he really didn't get into the intricate things that happened while he was a POW. I knew he met my mother there, married her, and so I knew that background. But as far as the individual acts of heroism that he actually provided, I never knew until he passed. And reading some documents that he had to submit to the VA opened up a whole new story.
Well, so you've learned a lot since his death, and you're going to learn even more because of the connection that we're going to hear about. So you knew that he was in the Air Corps. You knew that his plane was shot down in July of 1943, and you knew that he was a prisoner of war. Had he told you much about that experience as a prisoner?
He mentioned how the Germans treated him. Overall, the prison guards were pretty decent. He did say that the Gestapo, when they would come around, they were brutal, things like that. And some of the lousy food they had to eat and the cold conditions they endured and how people that tried to go over the wire were shot and killed, obviously, and he was there for that.
And you said he met your mother?
He met my mother while he was with the RAF, and they fell in love, got married. My sister was born, And shortly after her birth is when he got shot down on 26 July 1943.
But I'm doing the math here. If he didn't survive the prison camp, he doesn't get back with your mother and you're not here.
That's correct. In 1945, when they were liberated, he did a short stint with the American Red Cross over there and then came back Easter Sunday in 1946 on a troop ship. And my mother and her sister, who were also war brides, came over on the Queen Mary. And that's actually, I was on the Queen Mary before I was born. I just didn't know about it. And a month later, on June 22nd, I was born.
Well, all that in its own right is pretty hard to fathom. And your father's story is pretty incredible, to be so determined that through Canada, joins the Polish Air Force, then flies for the Brits, meets your mother, flies for the Americans, gets shot down, survives a long time, what, about 18 months in a prison camp or longer?
22 months he was incarcerated there. The day he was shot down, the story he told, he never remembered pulling his ripcord. He passed out. The gunner next to him, my father was a waist gunner, the other waist gunner received a headshot and died instantly. My father took 32 gunshot wounds and shrapnel wounds, and it's a miracle he didn't bleed out. But he woke up near the Bremen Canal and was captured, taken to a morgue where he again regained consciousness with two doctors standing over him arguing whether to try and save his life or not. The younger doctor did save his life. The real ironic part of this is the doctor would come check on him daily to see how he was progressing and then became very cold and standoffish toward my father. And one of the nurses told my father that this doctor's wife and two children had been killed by Allied bombers 2 days after he saved my father's life. I know my father carried that with him all his life, too.
Yeah. And so, I mean, this is an unbelievable story already. And your existence, in light of all that, is hard to believe. So your father had shared a fair amount about this. Over the years, though, since his death, have you ever had moments where you say, boy, I wish Dad told me about this, or I wish I knew some of those other people that helped him survive in the prison camp?
I certainly did. I think a person always would give their own life to have one day that they could spend back with their father and ask things that you never asked him before. I know that's the way I felt. And until I met Orville, he's given me a second chance on life to ask those questions that I never asked my father.
Yeah, so let's hear about this. Obviously, you have great respect for your father, and you're amazed by his story and how he survived all of that. But August 2015, you just drive down from Coarse Gold, which is north of Fresno, for a medical appointment, and what happens next?
I'm sitting in the waiting room, and I see this older gentleman come in with an 8th Air Force ball cap on. And so I thought, that's the same outfit my father was with, but, it's a big outfit. So I asked him, I said, so you were in the 8th Air Force? And he said, yeah. And I said, B-17s? He said, yeah. And I said, my father was in a B-17 and shot down over Hanover, Germany, on the 26th of July, 43. And Orville, who I met with the 8th Air Force hat on, said, that's really something. I was shot down 4 days later on the same mission, same target, and taken prisoner of war. One thing led to another. I learned that Orville and my dad were both put in the same prison camp, Stalag 17B, just outside of Krems, Austria. And not only that, they were in the same barracks. And since then, I've learned that they were buddies to some extent. They talk frequently, and I never knew this. It's amazing.
Have you even tried to fathom the odds of this? I mean, I've interviewed hundreds of veterans and dozens of prisoners of war, even guys that were in the same prison camp and now lived, within 50 miles of each other. But it's very rare to have guys that actually knew each other in a camp. You have thousands and thousands of people. That camp had at least 40,000 people inside it at one time or another, not that many Americans. But for them to be in the same barracks at the same camp and then you to run into them all these years later, impossible.
Yeah, it's got to be a million to one shot. It still boggles my mind. They say nothing happens just for coincidence. There's a reason for everything, and I'm a firm believer of that.
And unfortunately, that day where you met him at the VA, you had to go into an appointment, so you really didn't get to talk to him much, right?
That's correct. All I got was Orville's name, and in that time, the nurse called me in, And I went in for my appointment. When I came out, he was gone, and I was totally frustrated. I even went up to the VA nurse to see if she'd give me his name, knowing she wouldn't because of confidentiality matters. I did have his name, I just didn't have his phone number. So I did some research on my own and found Orville's son on Facebook and put two and two together, found out that it must be the same family, and found Orville again that way.
I'm imagining myself in your shoes here. Here you've got this story that's been with you your whole life, that's part of the story of your life, and all of a sudden you've got this bright glimmer of hope that you're going to learn all these things, and then you come out and he's gone. And what was that roller coaster ride like?
It was just a roller coaster ride for sure. Here I had a guy that knew my dad, and I had no way of communicating with him anymore. It was just very, very frustrating.
Now, you guys have had some time to look at some pictures, to go over different memories. What has that done for you? What are some of the things that you've learned, or some of the picture that's been filled in for you?
Well, it's been terrific. It's helped me to realize what kind of environment they were actually in and what they endured. I looked at my father's wartime logbook and showed it to Orville, and there's names in there that he remembers, and he went over the Christmas menu of 1943, or maybe it was 44, and he remembers what they served that day, and I have the menu right here in my father's book. It's amazing.
It really is, and I don't want to be melodramatic or try to make more of it than it is, but it is amazing and very significant. How would you put into words what this means to you, to have someone who knew your dad, who can fill in some of those blanks, who maybe can corroborate some things you wondered about or answer questions that you thought would never be answered? What has this meant to you?
Well, it's meant the world to me. It's like I said before, it's almost a second lease on life for me, being able to ask questions to a living soul rather than read it in a history book, and knowing somebody that was basically a bunk buddy of my dad's while held by the Germans during World War II way back when.
Has it given you even more respect for your father, or more understanding about who he was? How has it added to your perspective on him?
Well, I always had a real strong respect for my father. Most of this stuff that I've talked to you about that I have learned since his passing, I learned by reading some documentation that he himself had to provide for the VA at his time of a claim for the wounds that he received. But no, it just solidifies in my mind what all these men during World War II gave for their country. The fact that they went up in this B-17 aircraft that was not much more than a Coors Silver Bullet with guns. And, I mean, the aluminum, I've seen these planes in person. There was nothing there to stop a bullet. It was just strictly, here I am, and come and get me, and may the best man win.
And hearing from Orville what life in that POW camp was like, adding that to what you already knew from your father, does it change at all your perspective on your own existence and the fact that you're even born?
Well, it makes me feel how lucky I really am. At any given time, he should have bled out when he was hit with that gunfire. He didn't. He survived. He survived through the camp, served on the escape committee. He himself could have been killed for doing numerous things that the Jerrys, which is what they called the Germans, didn't approve of. And he made it back to England, back to my mother and his daughter, and ended up in California, and the rest is history.
Yeah, and I don't want to keep going over the same stuff, but you say being back to California. Even if there was a guy still alive who was in the same barracks as your father, what are the odds that the two of you are both going to end up in Fresno on the same day, in the same room, at the same VA center?
This is truly so unique. The time span involved, that we're talking 72 years, and then we meet up. It's just totally amazing. They could make a movie on this incident, and it would sell.
They really could. And perhaps that gives a little hope or inspiration to some of you who no longer have your fathers to celebrate this Father's Day weekend. Maybe it's time to do a little research or follow through on some ideas you've had that you haven't acted on yet, and you might learn more. And wouldn't you like to hear the other side of that wild small world connection story? We're going to do that when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com, for Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special Father's Day edition of the program. When we left off, we'd heard one perspective on an incredible small world connection that took place in a VA waiting room. The son of an ex-prisoner of war meeting someone who had stayed in the very same barracks and prison camp with his late father. Now let's hear the other side from World War II veteran Orville Lewis.
When this young man stops you at the VA, asks you about your 8th Air Force hat, and tells you that his dad was in the same POW camp as you and shot down 4 days apart, did you believe him?
I sure did. I'd been waiting, hoping to run into someone that come in contact with that I knew in prison camp, and this was it. And it kind of surprised me. I met Ernie Lewis, who happened to be on the crew of Les's dad, and he lived in Eureka, California, and I was real good buddies with him, and I went up and visited with him. And he is the only one I've ever come in contact with, except until I met Les.
But you always kind of had that in the back of your mind, that that would be neat if that could happen?
Yes, it sure did. And I tried to find someone. I just never had been able to.
What have you gotten out of this so far? I know you guys are just getting to know each other, but what has it meant to you to spend this time with Les?
Well, it kind of sure brings back some memories. I really enjoyed talking to Les on everything. And if I can help him remember something about his dad, I'd be glad to do so. And I've got a lot of stories I could tell him. It'll probably make his hair stand on end, but I've still got them there. I'll tell him about them.
What do you remember about his father?
Well, all I remember about him, he was a very quiet guy. He wasn't boisterous or outgoing, but he was quiet and soft-spoken and a real nice guy.
And when we talk about being in the same barracks, help us understand how amazing that is. How many people would have been in your barracks, and how close was his father to where you stayed?
Well, the barracks were divided into two parts. There's 160 men on each end of the barracks. This father happened to be in the same end that I was in the barracks. I remember the number. It was 36. His bunk was about 10 feet one direction and about 20 feet the other, about 30 feet away from where I slept. That was just about all I can tell you about the location. We were very fortunate to be in the same end of the barracks, and it's very unusual to have met someone that knew anyone in my end of the barracks.
Yeah, it's really hard to believe. I guess it would be interesting, too, to discuss your fourth mission, because this is the same mission on which Les's father was shot down. July 26, 43, Hanover was the target, and that sounds like that was a pretty eventful mission for all the B-17s in the air.
It was. I know we lost a lot of planes that day. I don't remember the exact number, but we lost real heavy that day. We was attacked from the time we hit across the English Channel until we got back. Even our plane happened to get attacked as we got back to the channel that day. Well, there's Miss 210s, the fighter bombers. There's three or four of them. I think there was four. Just getting to the White Cliffs of Dover there, here they came. Right, she was by herself. But we put one of them down in smoke. I don't know whether he went on down or not, but I had my flight suit halfway down around my feet, and I couldn't get around in time. I told the pilot and co-pilot I got caught with my pants down that time.
Literally.
Yeah, literally. But we drove them off anyway.
Well, you say that like that's not a big deal. But I want people to understand, first of all, you've survived fighters all the way to the target, all the way from your base in England, all the way into Germany, Hanover, fighters all the way, flak over the target. You're on the way home. You're almost home. And how many German planes are coming for just your plane?
I'm pretty sure there's just four of them.
Only four. Oh, that's four against one. That's not a bad odds or anything. So, and you're on the top turret?
Correct. And I asked the pilot to lower his left wing, which he did. And it looked like my tracer was going into that plane, but he kept flying. But he left us alone after that.
How do you keep your wits about you in that situation? Because you're outnumbered. They've got more firepower than you do. Their planes are faster than yours. How do you keep functioning and do what you have to do?
I don't know. You just automatically train to do it, I guess, because you know you have to do it. One plane that day, an FW-190, that was Gehring Circus, we called him. He came down. I was after a plane in front of me, and I looked up at an angle. Here come one. I ducked my head. His prop was that close. My turret was too slow to get on him. The time I got on him, he was flying through the formation. I couldn't shoot at him because it would hit my own plane. But I actually, his prop was within inches of my head. But my turret was too slow to get around on him. You just automatically, you fight. You just do what you have to do. I'll tell you this much. Every flight I made, I'll never make another flight. But you know, the next morning we'd be out there running around, ready to go again next morning.
So you get home from them, oh, I don't ever want to do that again, but you're right back at it. And I'm glad you said that, because as I look at the dates of all the missions that you flew, you guys really were flying almost every day. How exhausting was that?
It was very exhausting. And I tell you, if it lasted, I don't know of anyone that made those 25 missions back in those days. They told me if you make three of them, you're very fortunate. And I'll tell you, it was rough.
Well, and you were in so early, maybe they didn't tell you this, but I've had guys tell me that when they went to aerial gunnery school, as you did, that a lot of times an instructor would get their attention by giving them the average life expectancy of a gunner in aerial combat?
Yes, I was told that through gunnery school.
What did they quantify it as?
Oh, I think it was in the seconds. It sure wasn't in the minutes. In actual combat, it was in seconds.
That gets your attention a little bit. Let's talk about your seventh and final mission. Castle, Germany is the target, July 30th, 1943. And I imagine July 30th is a day you've never forgotten. It certainly changed your life, didn't it?
It was the day I was inducted into the service and the day I was shot down, 1 year to the day.
Makes it a pretty special day every year for you, I guess. So take us start to finish from that day. It must have been a pretty long day for you, but remember for us what you can.
As we got out over the English Channel, I test-fired my gun. They were perfect. And we hadn't much more than got. We were over Belgium, which is not very far inland, whenever the sky just blacked out in front of us. It was flak. We were flying 21,000. And as far as I know, we were tailing Charlie. We'd had the trouble getting the plane right. Something went wrong, and we were tailing Charlie, and the planes kept aborting. First time we'd ever got 500 bombers in the air, but they were aborting so fast that we just kept pulling up, and we got way up into the formation. Just as we settled down, we were hit. We got a direct hit through number three gas tank, and that fuel poured all over the plane, and the metal was spewing all over us, and there were fighters coming in. Well, I put my chute on and crawling back up my turret to get a shot at them. Co-pilot pulled me down, said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Get out of here." Well, metal was spewing all over us, and the radio man and I were supposed to go out to Bombay. Well, I saw the Bombay doors, and then I give a hard tug, and the bomb dropped, and the flames were coming up and just lapping up, and I timed it in between those flames and jumped out. Radio man, I talked to him later, said he opened the door, he just slammed it back, said all he could see was fire in there, so he went back and jumped out the rear, the left-hand side of the fuselage. At that time, they had where the door gunners were. He went out that side, so I timed myself, looked at my little chute, it was an English, well, it was an emergency chute, 22-foot, and you hit the ground hard with them. Well, I checked to see it wasn't on fire, and I laid there, and the wind whistled around the airplane going on away. Finally, I decided I'll pull a ripcord because I couldn't up there at 21,000 because of no oxygen. I was breathing real hard, and so finally I couldn't find it. And I knew it had to be there. I thought, well, that isn't there. I got to rip this thing apart. Well, I found it finally, and I jerked it, and I was laying flat on my back, and in my head and heels felt like they touched, and it hurt me pretty bad because the chute didn't fit me. The first time I was in the service, I had the chute adjusted, and they gave me the wrong harness back. And I never put it on when I left, and I should have. But anyway, I was going down, fighter planes coming in, and I thought, well, I was on target for them. But the German came through, and he gave me a prop wash, and it folded my chute up. I tried to straighten it out, and I made it worse. So I made up my mind that from now on I'll just leave it alone. And then the other plane went by, and they waved at me, those German pilots. I waved back at him. Shoot me, go ahead.
You mean he waved with his hands or he tipped his wings? He waved with his hands at you. He was that close.
He actually that close, he waved with his hand. And then one of the guys, I could see him floating down the chute out there, and I yelled at him and waved at him. He never did answer me or wave back. Anyway, I hit the ground in what was the name of that little town in Belgium? I forget. Oh, Antwerp. It wasn't too little. Yeah. Well, then in the gutter of the street there, the guy with a double-barrel shotgun in Belgium, he pointed that gun at him to help. He captured me, you know, but he helped me roll my chute up, and here come the Germans on motorbikes, two of them. I couldn't run. I couldn't do anything. My back was hurting me. And so they come up and stuck a little gun in my stomach and hands up. So I put my hands up. They searched me, and the Gestapo came along in the car. I had a chauffeur, and he riding in the back, threw me in the car with him. And he gave me a hard time. I said, well, we didn't start the war. You guys started. And I shouldn't have said that. He blew his lid, boy, and I thought, sure, he's going to shoot me. Said, my home was in Cologne. Said, his family was all killed. The bombers did it. Because at Cologne was where they had a ball bearing factory, and we'd hit it pretty hard. And his family was killed. Well, they picked up many Belgians got around that car that they grabbed an old lady and threw her in the car with us. And they took us out to headquarters and went on with her and took me in and interrogated me, wanted to know where we were going, how I was flying, all that. And I'd give my name, rank, and serial number, and that was it. I wouldn't give him any more.
He would spend the better part of 2 years in captivity. Stalag 17B is where Orville got to know Les Beck's father and learned how to survive on very little food and lots of creative thinking.
We kept a map of where the front line was going all the time. Germans come in, looked at them, just shake their head and walk off. They knew what we were doing, but they couldn't find them.
Where would you guys hide them?
Well, I don't know. I'd give it back to the other guys. I don't know what they did with it today. But I've set up my time 2 or 3 times in the BBC news. And I heard Hitler one time. He was ranting and raving. He wanted all prisoners killed. That's toward the end. And good thing you didn't listen to him.
Well, yeah, but you don't know whether or not they're going to listen to him. You've been there since October of 43. Now you're into the spring of 45. And Hitler's on there saying, kill all the prisoners. You're one of the prisoners. Is that something that you passed on to the rest? Because you're monitoring the radio when you hear this.
We had a barracks chief, and we'd have the news every day. And we had some word we used when the Jerry's were coming. And everybody being away from nothing going on. They'd walk in.
So if they were coming, you would scramble to look like you were doing nothing.
Correct. One time I scrambled out the window and I done the wrong thing. The old camp commandant, big old belly, walking by. I jumped out, and I couldn't stop, and I hit him right in the belly. So I went out the window, and the guys were running in all directions because he was going to make us fill in the tunnel. And I ran in among them, and they never really catch me.
Tell me about how you finally realized how it happened that you were finally a free man again after almost 2 years of not knowing freedom, not tasting freedom.
Oh, it felt really good, but I'll tell you a little story on that. That was at La Havre. They're building an airstrip. The first plane that landed there was a B-17. Well, I was in a tent with about 12 or 13 other guys. I went over there and I asked a pilot about a ride across the channel with him. He said, well, I'm not authorized to haul anyone, but said, I'm leaving, and he looked at his watch in about 10 minutes, and I'm not looking back in the fuselage. Somebody happened to be back there. I'm not looking back there. So I run back to the tent and I grabbed all the guys in there. We run back and jumped in that fuselage just as we slammed the door. He took off down the runway. And we landed not at the same base that I was based at, Thetford. the guys lined up for payday. I walked in there, they treated me like a king. I'm telling you, I enjoyed that. Then I realized I was free. But I went in and stayed all night. I got polluted. And Lion Chief and I were good buddies. And I stayed out in his cabin out on the line. The head cook of the place, I knew him real well because I was always coming in late and he was feeding us when here in the States. He gave him steaks and things for us to cook out in the Lion Shack. He said he got them done. I laid down on one of the bunks. He couldn't wake me up. He said he poured water on me and everything. I wouldn't wake up.
I think we can all understand why. We are out of time today, but it was fun to revisit some of those special memories in honor of Father's Day. If your dad is still with us, why not go beyond the standard Father's Day greeting and see if he has any special stories to share that maybe you haven't heard before? You never know where that's going to take you. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.